As we're talking about, grief is a big subject, and it's always good when you're thinking about a subject like this is to not just think about the subject as a general, but as a general thing, but to kind of calmly, carefully think about, have you had moments in your life where you've had grief? It might be, for example, that you've lost a pet, something even small like that. Grief can come from something where you have, it's basically an expression of loss. It might have been something that you once had and have lost, like a pet. It could be something, for example, like a divorce, the death of a loved one. Sometimes it's the loss of something that you might have had. It's something that you might have gotten if you had, for example, you might have been hoping for a raise or a promotion, but you didn't get that, and so you've lost something that you never had, as it were. It could be sorrow over all sorts of different things, and people have drawn up lists of different kinds of emotions, different kind of grief. The biggest grief is the death of a person, but then there's other things like moving out, moving to a new neighborhood. Of course, you're going to get something positive out of moving somewhere else, opportunities that you didn't have before, but there are also things that you've lost. Even when you know that there's something that might be positive coming out of it, you've still lost something. When you do grieve, of course, you want, grief is a very lonely thing. We read from Lamentations chapter 1, verse 1, the very, very first phrase is, "How lonely sits the city that was once full of people." Grief is lonely. Grief makes you sit. It says, how lonely sits the city. The city can't move. It can't go on because loneliness accompanies grief. And so when you're grieving, you want to share it with someone. You want someone to console you. Now, in the book of Job, you see that this man going through incredible suffering. He wants his friends to console him, and for the first week they do because they say nothing. Things only get worse when they actually start to speak. But grief is, you want company when you're grieving. When we experience these things, we do share them with people. But usually when you share them with people now, what kind of reaction do you get? As I said, in my experience, the reaction I get is some kind of, there's all sorts of ways that people respond to grief. When they hear someone else's grief, very often the response is, they try to sound like they understand, even though they probably don't. So they say something like, "Oh, I know how hard it is for you." Well, the problem is that the person saying that might not actually understand what it's like for you. They might start to compare your suffering with somebody else's. They might say something like, well, it's not as bad as what I went through. It's not as bad as what other people might go through. And so by making that comparison, they can minimize what you're going through. Sometimes it's a matter of they just try to outrightly minimize it by saying, it's not as bad as you think. You'll get over it. We've all got to get over it. And we start using words like phrases over it, although they don't tell you how you get over it or what you do with it. And then in churches, sometimes it can actually be made worse. In churches, there is often an assumption that things will blow over, we have to handle it ourselves, we have to soldier on. And I think really the reason people do that is because they don't want to get stuck in it themselves. They have got their own unresolved grief. No one showed them how to grieve, and so they don't know how to handle it when someone else sees it. They want to wash their hands like Pilate, I just don't know how to deal with this. Although they won't say that. They'll say, "Oh, I'm there for you, I'm there for you." But what they mean by that is a bit uncertain. I mean, in what sense are they there for you? Then they start to think about attributions of blame. I mean, for example, with Job, he was an innocent sufferer, yet his friends all thought he had done something wrong. He must have done something. So we go on this scavenger hunt for blame. We've got to find a way to blame. And if we can't blame anything, we'll try and blame the person who's suffering. That's even worse. In Lamentations, it's a different situation because there is actually an explicit reason why this is happening. It actually says here in verse, for example, I can't find it here. One verse 14, my transgressions were bound into a yoke. By his hand they were fastened together and they were set upon my neck. He caused my strength to fail and gave me into the hands of those I cannot withstand. So effectively, Israel has sinned by abandoning God. If you ever read Deuteronomy chapter 28, in the warnings against disobedience, word for word, it's describing exactly the same thing as what happens in Lamentations. It's freaky in how similar they are, but that's because the warning was there. In Leviticus 26, it's the same thing. If you disobey, this is what happened to you. And Israel had been warned for years to stop through Elijah, through Elisha. And eventually in 586 BC, the Babylonian army comes and takes Jerusalem, destroys the temple and everything else. And so this is a long poem in Lamentations of Lament. And one of the problems is that there is none to comfort. It says in 1 verse 2, he has none to comfort. In 1 verse 9, she has no comforter. In 1 verse 16, a comforter is far from me. That expression, there is no comforter, comes up again and again and again. What's interesting about the prayer, about the book, is that it does not directly address God. It does not speak to God. It speaks about him. It lays blame to him for what has happened, although it also takes personal responsibility for what has happened. But it is a poem, it's a series of poems that reflect upon the events. The events are described elsewhere in, for example, 2 Kings, I think chapter 25, about the coming of the Babylonian army. But this book of Lamentations actually goes through it. It actually slows everything down. And what it does is it actually gives us a time, it gives the writer a time to think. The fact is, the writer, who is a man, cannot get that kind of comfort from anybody else. So he's trying to write this book to get that comfort from others. And so he's trying to get that comfort from writing it and having someone read it. It's very passionate. There's so much. He uses metaphors. He uses lots of powerful imagery to do this. For example, in 1 verse 8, Jerusalem sinned grievously. She became filthy. All who wanted her despised her, for they've seen her nakedness. It's like someone seeing a woman naked. In 1 verse 9, it says her uncleanness was in her skirts. I mean, that's really vivid, powerful imagery. And he uses this all the time, again and again and again. He doesn't say statements like, I felt sad, I felt lonely. He uses imagery so that people see that themselves and feel it deep in their hearts. And so what Lamentations is, and why I love this book, is because it gives people the ability to express feeling. It gives them to express the horror of what they're going through. They can put it down. And one of the reasons that's powerful is that when you're going through grief, very often you can't find the words. It's so overwhelming. But there is a power in words. There's a power in being able to put emotions to pen, to express them. Even when you can't express the emotions, you haven't got the words for the emotions, you can express it through an image. And often metaphor is much more powerful than a word. You know, I am sad, I am angry. Well, you can say something like, you know, my anger is so overwhelming, I wanted to smash a tile. I wanted to hit the mirror. I wanted to throw a brick at a wall. That conveys the feeling much, much stronger than simply a statement. And you think about Jesus. You know, we think about Jesus as this man who was joyful. Jesus was joyful, and it says in elsewhere in Scripture that for the joy set before him, he endured the cross and scorned its shame in the book of Hebrews. But the thing is that when we see descriptions of Jesus in the Bible, how is Jesus described as? In Isaiah 53, it says, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Verse 4, he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. The first thing that Jesus is described as, one of the first things in the Old Testament he is described as, is a man familiar with sorrow. He knows sorrow. He felt sorrow. And it's very amazing that he did this. He did not rushed sorrow. He did not get around sorrow. He went to the cross willingly. In the Garden of Gethsemane in Matthew 26, he's praying and weeping tears with blood coming out. He never shortcuts sorrow, because he knows that to get to the joy, you have to first go through the sorrow. To get the prize, you have to run the race. And the race is not easy. The race is painful, requires lots of effort. But the reward is that once you get there, the reward is on the other side. Our world doesn't understand this, because our world and a lot of our churches want to shortcut it. We want to get around it. We want you to just put on the smiley, happy face and let it all go away. You know, when the skies don't clear up, put on a happy face. Well, often there is no happy face. There is no easy way out. Our world loves easy ways out, because we have technology that makes everything instant. We want to instantly have a good marriage. We instantly want to have good children. We instantly want to have intelligence. We instantly want to make problems go away and whitewash things. But Jesus doesn't do that. The most powerful example of this is in John 11, where he's talking with, he's raising Lazarus from the dead. And actually it says that Jesus groaned in his spirit, verse 33, and was troubled. Verse 35, he weeps. And then again, Jesus groaned in himself, verse 38, he comes to the tomb. He's raising a friend that he knows will be raised again. But when he sees grief, and when he sees other people's sadness, and he sees the death of a good friend, he cries. He weeps. It actually says he groans in himself. He is sickened. He's retching, like he wants to vomit. And it's interesting, because you would have thought that Jesus would have said something like, "Oh, it's all right. I'm about to raise him from the dead, so don't worry about it." Or "Don't worry, Lazarus is dead. He was a Christian, so he's in a happy place. We don't have to worry about it." But Jesus doesn't do that. He weeps. I think by him weeping, he's giving other people the power to weep, to grieve. But our sorrows can be taken to God. And Jesus doesn't run around this. He doesn't skirt around it. He accepts it and he takes it. And I think that's really the thing here. And one of the reasons why we have that lengthy reading this morning from Lamentations chapter 3 is that it's saying that even when there's grief, grief can come from different places. Sometimes it's not our fault. Sometimes the death of someone that we know is not our fault. But we can grieve that to God. However, if there is something that we're responsible for, if there's something we've done that has brought about consequences from God, because we have been pushing him away for so long with an addiction or with a sin or something else that's been happening, even then God is still gracious. Even then God is still actually working. It says, chapter 3, verse 25, the Lord is good to those who wait for him and for the soul who seeks him. Verse 33, verse 28, let him sit alone in silence when it is laid on him. You know, we can actually meditate on God, think about what we've done wrong, go back to him. And the amazing thing about Lamentations is that it's not only taking grief to God, it's expecting that he will see it, that he will work, he will do something about it, he'll do something with it. And even when the sad circumstances are directly the responsibility of the person who is suffering it, God, because he is a faithful covenant partner, will actually bless the person, forgive them, and give them a new, turn over a new leaf for that person. So Lamentations is full of hope. And the last two verses of the book are full of hope, because in the last two verses of Lamentations, he says, God will restore. Unless he remain exceedingly angry. And there is hope that he will not remain exceedingly angry, but will actually turn the situation around. And that's the thing, is that we don't have to rush that. We don't have to rush to the good bits. We don't have to rush to them. But we will eventually get there, because as we get rid of the grief, we get rid of the sadness, we take it to God, we weep it out, we tell him how bad it is in all its graphic detail, then actually you'll find that burden coming off eventually, and then God will actually work in it and do something with it. Now, it might take a lot of time and effort, and it might be confusing at times, but that's the amazing thing that you see in Lamentations, is that grief is not something you need to hide from God. You can take it to him. One of the greatest books I ever read on grief was actually one called by C.S. Lewis called The Grief Observed, which he wrote when his wife died. Originally, when he wrote it, he used a pseudonym because he didn't want people to know it was him. because up until that point, he'd been a great defender of Christianity. But when his wife died, he found all this confusion and uncertainty, and he didn't know what to do with it. So he wrote a book reflecting on it. And out of that book, it blessed a lot of people, because he said, you know, but with this, I realize that I'm still dependent on God. He gave me this wife. She was taken from me. But all it showed was that, you know, I was leaning on a house of cards anyway. And by taking that away from me and letting the house of cards fall down, I realized still that I needed him. And so that book that he wrote was able to bless many people. And that's what grief can do. It takes you into God in ways that you never could have when everything was going well. And so it doesn't matter what you're going through. God will always take you as you are. He will always listen to any problem you have, no matter how big or small, no matter how dark it is. And I think it actually is a test of faith that you take it to him. If you don't take it to him, are you really trusting him? Are you really trusting God with all your life? If you only give him the good bits, if you only give him the happy bits, if you keep the dark stuff from him or the sadness from him, does that really give him honor? Well, it's not if you think about it, because you're keeping something from him, something that he can come and help you with. And it'd be horrible if you got to the end of your life and he said, well, why didn't you give that to me? And you said, well, I was afraid you wouldn't know how to. And he's like, I'm God. I can take anything. And you labored with that. You had that hanging around you all that time when I could have taken it from you. Or you could have surrendered it to me and I could have done something amazing with it. So I would encourage anyone going through difficult times to take it to God. Take it to people in your community who love and care for you and know how to help you.
So we're now here at the time of Q&A, and just looking at Padlet, there's actually quite a few that's come in already. So I'll start from the top. Okay, so first question, Hayden. Hopefully I can structure this correctly. So it says, how do we comfort our non-Christian friends in words for their loved ones who have died, as well as Christian friends who might have loved ones who are not believers? I hope I structured that correctly.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's very hard, actually, because in 1 Thessalonians, I think it is, Paul says to the church, we do not grieve like those who have no hope. So for the Christian, when Christians grieve for Christians, it's a lot easier because we have hope. It's still sad when they die, but there's hope because they're going somewhere else, and we have certainty of that. Mm. When it's not a Christian, it's not so easy. Some Christians want to rush into that and use it as an opportunity to share the gospel, but I don't think that's a good thing to do in the beginning. The best thing to do when someone's in emotional pain, whether they're Christian or non-Christian, is just to listen to it. Just take it in, hear them on their own terms. There is maybe a tendency, like a temptation to want to try and correct them, but that won't help because they just want to be listened to. Even if what they're saying is nonsense, listen to it. Pray beforehand that God will give you the listening skill and the ability to say that, to give a timely word, but don't feel in any rush like you have to say anything. And then when they're ready, you see, often people just want someone to listen to them, even if what they're saying is nonsense. Even if what they're saying is wrong or anything like that, they want someone to listen to the feeling. So my suggestion would be just to listen to them. And then when they're ready, when they're calmed down, when they're in a more rational state of mind, you can start to talk to them about issues of death, but not to do it in a way that sounds bombastic or dictatorial. But, you know, have you thought about what happens to you after you die? One of the reasons, see, when people grieve for someone else dying or for a loss, they're grieving themselves. They're not grieving the person who's died. They're grieving themselves. They're thinking, is this going to happen to me one day? That's scary. They're not just thinking that, but very often they've got this inner unspoken fear. So when they've had time to express that fear, express that thing, then you might start to ask them things like, well, you know, have you thought about death? Have you thought about what's going to happen to you when you die? I mean, you live this life on earth for 80 years or 70 years or whatever it is, then someone dies. Well, you know, what's going to happen afterwards? You know, and that can actually be an opening. But as I said, that's got to be very delicately done. It can't be forced. It can't be conjured up and conjectured like it's, you know, to make it sound like you're forcing their grief to that conclusion. But you, it is a way to do it. It's a great opportunity to do it. But as I said, it's better, I think, to listen to the pain first and then graduate onto talking about, you know, trusting Jesus afterwards. But it has to be done at the right time in the right way.
Mm. Yeah, so it's always hard to try and find the right actions to do during those situations. So hopefully that answers the question, whoever may have asked that. Next question. So, I mean, during the message, it seems like, you know, we've been encouraged to take our griefs to God. Next question is, what does it mean to lament? Like, how do I practically do it if I'm sad? How do I take it to God?
Great, excellent question. My thesis has been about writing it in poetry. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, I think creative outlets are incredibly helpful for grief. Whether you're drawing a picture, whether you're painting, whether you're writing a poem. And I think poems are more, you know, paintings are one way of expressing it because it's expressing the soul in ways that words cannot do. But I also think it's good to write it in poetry or even just to write it down, even if it's not poetic, even if you just write it down on a piece of paper about certain situations you've been with, someone you're angry with, who was meant to give you love but didn't give it to you. There's grief associated with that. There's anger. And grief goes with anger, or anger goes with grief, frustration, hurt, shock. And so it's not just lament. There's a whole pile of emotions. And I think it's always worthwhile to write them down and be as specific as possible. Even if you can't find the right word, to write them down as best you can, because what it does is it helps your mind to focus on something. If you're finding yourself getting very overwhelmed with grief, it's very important, I think, to write it down and be as specific as possible. Don't worry about the spelling. Don't worry if it makes sense. Just write it down and journal it. When you've done that, you might put it away for a while, then you go back and look at it again and see what you've written, see what comes up. It might actually shock you to see what's in there, who you're angry with. You might actually be angry with the person that you're grieving. You might be angry with the people who've left you behind. There might be anger with God. You see that in Lamentations. There is anger with God that for many people find shocking when they read it because they think, you're talking to a holy God like this. Yeah. But the fact that Lamentations lets those frustrations be expressed, and they're also expressed in places like Psalm 13, Psalm 21, which Jesus quotes on the cross, the fact that those psalms are in there, Psalm 22, sorry, Jesus quotes on the cross, by allowing those psalms to be spoken, those frustrations and the anger with God to be spoken, it's actually allowing an openness. And so I think the more open you get with God, the better. When you do that, you might find a lot of emotions coming up. You might find a lot of anger coming up. You might find yourself crying all of a sudden, just out of nowhere. I would say, let that happen. Just let it happen. Let it out. Psalm 56, verse 8, you know, God, he sees our tears and he puts them in a bottle. I hope I got that reference right. He says, you know, he puts our tears in a bottle. He actually carefully hears our tears and actually our sorrows. Psalm 56, verse 8. You number my wanderings and put my tears into your bottle. Are they not written in your book? God actually records our sorrows. That's amazing. I don't know if anyone's ever said that to you about what God does with sorrow, but that's what he does. You know, God, how could you let this happen? Where were you when this happened to me? Why did you let this happen? I don't understand. Get it out, because when you read the Psalms and the Book of Lamentations, that's exactly what they do. Some people fear to tread there because they think, oh, it's not a righteous way to talk to God. But if that's what you're thinking, God sees it anyway. Because God doesn't need the information. He wants to hear it from us because it's us who need to hear it. We need to understand ourselves. We need to see ourselves as God sees us, as we truly are, not putting on this facade that everything's okay, actually taking it to him. You can write it as a poem. You can get it out in an artistic way, or you can just write it down, take it to God in prayer, warts and all. And I think passages like Genesis 42 to 50, where you see how Joseph handles his grief, how Jesus handles his grief when he's been crucified and betrayed, and speak very, very powerfully about grief. So I think that's those are some good things that you can do if that's what you're dealing with. If you've got other mature Christians who understand what that's like, you can talk to them, share with them, because you want to have supportive people with you, because you can't grieve on your own. It's too much. Mm-hmm. So you need that, but you don't want to do that with people who won't understand or who are going to belittle what you're going through, because if you do that, you'll keep your grief inside and then it'll grow. And what happens with unprocessed grief, you become melancholic, you become depressed, you can't see things clearly, you don't have hope. And then what happens is you become negative. And then as you become negative, people sense that, people keep away from you. And the more people keep away from you and the more you keep away from God, mm-hmm. The more negative you become. Kind of, you know, creates this vicious cycle. So I would say get it out as you can. If you feel angry, find some safe ways to get your anger out. Those are some practical things that you can do.
Yeah, really good insights there. So hopefully that is able to help regarding that question. The next question. So as you mentioned earlier, you know, when we do see Christians pass, we know there is hope. So what do you think will happen with our grief in heaven? Like, will we forget it?
Great question. That is a really good question. If you got your Bible, got the last book of the Bible? In Revelation, in the last, I think it's the last chapter of Revelation. So right at the end of the book, Revelation 21, verse 4. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more sorrow, death, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Think about that. For God to wipe away every tear, he's going to gather up all his saints first. When they stand before him, there'll be grief and tears. In fact, I actually believe that the right now as we speak, when the dead martyrs look upon earth and see what's happening on earth, they are already crying out. For example, in Revelation 6, verse 10, they cried out with a loud voice, "O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you judge and avenge the blood on those who dwell on earth?" The dead martyrs in heaven who are martyred for witnessing for Christ, who are up in heaven, are not just sitting up there enjoying heaven. What are they doing? They are in grief. I don't know if that shocked me when I first understood this, that the dead martyrs up in heaven are looking down on earth and they are seeing their fellow Christians being martyred like they were. And they are asking God, "God, how long? How long will it be until you act?" Yeah. That's the same question as Lamentations, by the way. And we think that's only happening down on earth. Quite shockingly, it's actually happening in heaven too. And what John is showing with that is that those questions, those prayers to God by the dead saints up in heaven, is that those prayers are going to God. He's doing something about it. That's why he's going to come and judge the earth. And when he does, he's going to gather everyone up and then wipe away every single tear from their eyes. And when he does wipe them away, there'll be no more. So God is actively going to do something about the tears. I believe Jesus, because he suffered death, he has gone through every dark door that we're going to go through. He is already in heaven saying, "Father, this is what it's like to go through death. This is what it's like to go through loneliness and fear. This is what it's like." And so we see Jesus, and this is what the writer of Hebrews is very big on showing people, is that Jesus understands everything that we went through. Temptation, not sin. Temptation, fear, loneliness, suffering. And because he's gone through it, that makes him the perfect high priest. So I think, God is going to do something about all that. But when after he gives that comfort, that stuff will be no more. And I think we'll even forget the sorrow. Like, they'll seem so far away and distant. It won't have any impact on us anymore.
Mm. Yeah, it's definitely something to look forward to. So we've got the next two. I'm probably going to put these two together. These are probably a bit more practical questions. Hopefully it's not too big of a question to ask at the same time, but I'll mix it two together. So I guess, assuming you are not harming yourself or others, is there a right and or wrong way to grieve? And is there a point when you're grieving too much and you should come out of it?
There's a lady called Kubler-Ross who came up with these different stages of grief. So one is denial, and you kind of go through these different stages. I haven't got them with me on hand. But the first stage is denial. I mean, people will deny that they're in grief. And then as they accept it and as they go through, they're able to find resolution. A person who is stuck in grief is very unhealthy. Queen Victoria, when she lost her husband, Albert, she used to lay his clothes on the bed every morning as if he was there. And she did this for a very long time because she was stuck in grief. Mm. So it's not good to stay there. You don't want to grieve for a long time because you do want to get to a point where you're released from it. So you don't want to focus on it all the time because that can give you, you can feel overwhelmed doing that. You feel morbid. As I said, you can become negative, focusing too much on it. So sometimes when I'm praying with God, something will come up that's very painful. I let that out. I take it to God. I let it out. And then once I've let it out, sometimes I might have to shout it to God, or I weep about it or something like that. I leave it with him. And then very often I ask him to come and bless me, come and give me his healing love. And I feel that. I feel this calm, this love that nothing else can give. And when that happens, I can feel that thing has gone, that it lifted. And often afterwards, I'll do something that's happy. You know, I might go exercise. I might go for a walk. I might eat something yummy because I don't want to get stuck and trapped in grief.
Mm.
But the more it's a bit like carrying a sack of potatoes. You take off one, you might not notice much of a difference. But when you take off another, you can slowly feel it getting lighter.
Mm.
And then as you do, it starts to lift, often by itself. You don't even have to kind of keep looking at it. It just starts to lift. That's why it's important to let other people, safe people, get involved in it too, because they can lift you up when you're going through hardship and when it's hard to look beyond everything. You can ask God, please give me people who can lift me up. But yeah, I think it's important to find safe ways to do things. If you're finding that when you're lamenting, you're also getting angry, find a healthy way to get your anger out. You can scream into a pillow. You can grab a rock and throw it off a cliff. You can grab a golf club and hit some balls at a driving range. You can do lots of things to safely get your anger out. And if you just need to cry, just do it. Don't worry about what other people might be thinking. Don't feel self-conscious. Go into a quiet place. You know, Jesus said, when you pray, go into a quiet place, close your door, talk to your Father. We find a safe place to do it. I often found that just by getting it out, the burden is much, much less. Mm. And it feels weird at the time, like, oh, this is all overwhelming. And it can be a bit like a Pandora's box. Like once you open up the door and let it out, other things start coming out. And then you can feel overwhelmed with that. But I'd say, you know, just find appropriate times and places to do it. And yeah, as I said, you'll often find that it just starts to come, like you just feel lighter over time.
Yeah.
I would also say don't rush grief. Don't try and get it done by next Wednesday. It's like trying to find a wife by next Wednesday. Good luck if you can do it, but you probably won't. So don't have artificial timelines and deadlines on things like this. Just let it come as it comes and deal with it as it comes. And
yeah, awesome. And our final question, and I think it really ties into what you said about just, you know, if you need to cry, you know, don't worry about what other people think. So the final question is, how are we able to encourage the men in our lives to be able to express their grief effectively? It's improving, but there's somewhat of a perpetuating expectation of guys to man up and bottle up their grief.
Yeah. Start somewhere. As I said, because men are wired a bit differently, I read this great article from my master's about men who grieve, and they said there was an academic called Nicholas Walterstorff, who he's a Christian academic in America, who lost his son Eric when in a mountain accident, and he wrote about his grief. And he said, as a man, my everyone tells me I shouldn't grieve. My pastor tells me I shouldn't. My church tells me I shouldn't. Everyone says I shouldn't. But he said, if I don't choose to grieve, if I don't choose to face it, I'm going to go into a dark place. I have to choose to grieve it. I have to choose to face it. And if I don't choose and make deliberate time and effort for it, it'll fall by the wayside, and then other problems will come up. And people who often have unprocessed grief have anger deep inside. And if they don't get it out and they don't choose to deliberately do it, it won't happen. So I find that it's important to have supportive people around who would encourage me to do that, and to deliberately choose to do it, even if you write it down or you just talk about it. I would definitely encourage men to do it, because as this person's asking, you know, quite rightly, a lot of men really struggle with this, and I struggle with it. It took me a while to get into a habit of doing it. And it doesn't come naturally, because naturally we want to avoid pain. We don't want to think about pain. We want to have it easy. But the thing is, the pain's still in there. Whether we face it or not, it's still in there. It's a bit like a pressure, like a pressure cooker. My wife is Korean, so we put rice in a pressure cooker. The pressure's still there whether you let the valve out or not. When you loosen the valve, you get that comes out. But the pressure's still there whether you touch the valve or not. And the thing is, if you touch the valve and you release it, it's coming out. If you don't and you try and open it while the pressure's still in there, you've got a bomb. That's what happens when lament is unprocessed. So I would say, yes, definitely make time for that. When you feel lament, when you feel grief coming up, when you feel anger associated with it, you might not be able to deal with it at the time that it's coming up, but you kind of hit the pause button, you go deal with it at a better time, and then you'll actually find that it's going. I went to a healing retreat once where this ministry said, you know, write down your lament, write down the names of the people you're angry with or the people that you feel sad about, things that you've lost and other sorts of things. So I wrote them down. And we went through this time of naming what we were angry about, naming what we were lamenting about. And then we spoke words of forgiveness over people who might have hurt us or whatever else the thing was. And then there was a fire, and we actually put the paper into the fire to say, I let it go. I let it go, and it no longer has a hold over me. I give it to God. I let that person go. And I found that very, very cathartic, very healing, because even if you don't put it in the fire, if you just throw it out in the garbage bin, it's gone. And you can actually feel it leave you. So I would say, definitely pursue that.